The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly for May the 26th. I'm Alok Jha. Coming up on this week's podcast...
It's partly about what works and what doesn't work, and some of it really does work, and some of it's absolutely, utterly useless. But it's also about what's safe and what's not safe.
Trick or treatment. We put alternative medicine in the dock as we discuss snake oil and placebos with science writer Simon Singh. Also in the show...
They wanted somebody on the panel who didn't come from a scientific background. I can tell you I really fulfil that criteria.
Fionn Haigh, one of the judges of the Royal Society Science Book Prize, tells us what she thinks is the key to communicating science well. Plus, the victory of reason. We bring you the results of the embryology debates in Parliament and supersized mice that eat birds. It's all coming up on Science Weekly from The Guardian. Once more, it's a bank holiday spectacular, and wherever you are, we hope you're not doing any painting or DIY. Remember, it's the last bank holiday till Christmas. Well, except for the one in August. Anyway, that doesn't matter now because it's all about the here and now. And speaking of which, the Guardian science correspondent James Randerson is here right now. James, this could be your last appearance for some time. Tell us why.
Well, yes, possibly. I'm about to become a dad.
Yeah, we've trailed this before.
I don't really know exactly when, though.
Well, exactly. So this, but you know, let's assume this is going to be our last one for a while. So give it all. Get angry, everything. We'll ask you what sort of dad you're going to be a bit later.
With feeling.
Once more, with feeling. Right, enough about life at home with the Randersons and on with the show.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Now, by the time you hear this podcast, the Guardian's Hay Festival will be in full swing. It'll bring together the very best in the world of literature and learning, soothes and trendy welly wearers. One of the biggest draws over the past weekend was for the talk given by the science writer Simon Singh. He was speaking about his latest book, Trick or Treatment, Alternative Medicine on Trial, which is co-written by Edzard Ernst, the world's first professor of complementary medicine. Now, homeopathy, the placebo effect, quackery of all sorts, they're all subjects we've delved into regularly here on Science Weekly. So I caught up with Simon before his talk and asked him to paint a picture of the alternative medicine industry.
Well, it works at every level. That's a weird thing. There's no simple definition of alternative medicine. And so we had to look at every single alternative therapy, and we had to look at it in the context of a variety of different ailments that people might use it for. So on the one hand, you have chiropractors doing back manipulation, spinal manipulation to treat back problems, which kind of works. Now, that's regulated. Not anybody can call themselves a chiropractor. It's regulated. But on the other hand, many chiropractors make unsubstantiated claims about treating asthma or colic or ear infections.
And that's by just moving the spine around.
Exactly. I'm relatively new to this. My co-author is a professor of complementary medicine and studied this for 15 years. He knew the story inside out. But for me, it was shocking to find out that the first ever chiropractic treatment was for deafness and then for heart disease. And so it really wasn't invented as a treatment for back pain, which is how we largely think of it today. And yet some of those historical uses of chiropractic are still available today. And people go there and they don't know. It's absurd to me, the fact that somebody would go to a chiropractor for treating colic for a young child. And yet people do that. So there we have a treatment that works in some cases, doesn't work for other cases, is regulated and sometimes makes some preposterous claims, and which is also potentially very dangerous. And again, I think the public don't really know some of the dangers that you might encounter with alternative remedies. The idea is it's safe, it's natural, it's traditional. People have used it for hundreds of years. How can it possibly be dangerous? Well, in some cases, it really is.
But how much are we spending on this, say, in this country? Is there a figure for how much people spend on things like herbal medicines and things that don't have peer-reviewed science behind them?
It's a hard number to pin down, depending on the definition of alternative medicine. But one of the estimates is £5 billion a year, of which £4.5 billion is spent out of our own pockets and half a billion is NHS money spent on alternative therapies. It's a controversial number, but we're certainly talking about a billion rather than, say, a million.
Right. I mean, your book is a sort of a very sort of cold but passionate look at different types of alternative medicine.
I was getting very angry as I was writing this book, and I had to occasionally calm down and take it.
So you start, actually, the first chapter is How Do You Determine the Truth? And it's a description of the scientific method. I mean, we've talked on this podcast many times before about what science is. Give us a pen portrait of that. And also, you wrote the book with Edzard Ernst, who's the world's first professor of complementary medicines. What was his input into it?
Oh, right. So Edzard has a very conventional background. He studied medicine in Vienna and Germany, and then when he got towards the end of his career, he thought, what am I going to do? Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to apply all the science that I've learned in conventional medicine and the clinical trial, the double-blind test, etc., and I'm going to apply that to alternative medicine. He also had a career as a homeopath when he graduated from medical school. So he knows about homeopathy. He's indulged in some alternative treatments, and now he spent 15 years testing them.
So did he change his mind about homeopathy?
Yes, very much so, because yeah. I think if you're a doctor and you're faced with a patient and you give them a homeopathic pill, in many cases, the patient gets better. But why does that patient get better? Is it because of the placebo effect? Is it because of conventional drugs they're taking? Is it because of the body's own healing abilities? I think 90% of back problems clear up within 6 weeks, just spontaneously. And so as a practitioner in the early days, he thought homeopathic pills were really doing the trick. But in chapter one, we explain how you would test that hypothesis. And the clinical trial dates back just a couple of hundred years, really. I think about 1785 is what I remember. James Lind, a Scottish naval surgeon, went to sea and decided to investigate scurvy. Scurvy was taking out, tens of thousands of sailors were dying. People would voyage around the world and maybe lose a dozen or 20 or so a dozen or so sailors from conflict with pirate ships or other ships, but they would lose hundreds of sailors from scurvy, vitamin C deficiency, which we now know is the cause of it. But at that time, nobody knew the cure or the cause, and so they tried giving sailors sulfuric acid and vinegar and cider and salt water. And Lynn said, hang on, look, let's do a controlled test. Let's get 12 sailors, put them in pairs. We'll give two of them salt water, two of them cider, two of them sulfuric acid, two of them lemon juice. He put them in the same conditions, in the same part of the ship, gave them the same diet. They all started off with the same level of scurvy. So very controlled. And within a week, it was very clear that those sailors taking lemon juice were making miraculous recoveries. So there you have a very clear indication of how you use science to test whether or not a treatment works. And we start with that because what we're trying to say is the conclusions that come out of this book aren't dependent on our own experiences as authors. They're not dependent on our own prejudices. They're based on cold, dispassionate experiments, observation, clinical trials done by dozens, hundreds of researchers. And in fact, in homeopathy alone, there have been over 200 trials. So this isn't an area that hasn't been investigated, but it's an area where the results haven't really been brought together in a way that the public can understand.
That was Simon Singh. More from that interview later in the programme, and indeed more from the Hay Festival in our magnificent daily podcast. You'll find all you need to know about the Haycast, see what we've done there, at guardian.co.uk/audio. I'm Alok Jha, you're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come.
I think a good science book needs to have a really riveting message. It needs to have a good structure and a good compelling presentation. And then it needs to be written in a style that's accessible to you and me, to people who are not scientifically trained.
What makes a winning science book? We hear from the Royal Society Book Prize judge, Fionn Haigh. But first, here's a pick of the other stories making science headlines over the past 7 days. Here's producer Ben and James with your news jam.
News jam.
UK stem cell scientists were breathing a collective sigh of relief last week as MPs voted in favour of controversial legislation to allow the creation of human-animal hybrids for research purposes. Parliamentarians also supported relaxing the rules on creating so-called saviour siblings and keeping the upper limit for abortions at 24 weeks.
Scientists have warned that carbon nanotubes could pose a cancer risk similar to that of asbestos, saying the government should restrict the use of the materials to protect human health. The new research shows that in mice, the tubes cause inflammation of the mesothelium, the slippery membrane around the lungs. With asbestos, this is a precursor to cancer.
In a Jurassic Park-like experiment, scientists have resurrected genes from the Tasmanian tiger by injecting them into mouse embryos. The stripy, wolf-like creatures, which were the largest of the carnivorous marsupials, were wiped out in the wild by intensive hunting in the early 1900s.
And finally, Gough Island, a remote outcrop in the South Atlantic, has become the stage for one of nature's great horror shows. A population of British house mice that hitched a lift there with whalers 150 years ago has evolved into a set of voracious carnivores. The mice, which have grown to three times the normal size, are now threatening rare nesting seabirds by feasting on live albatross, petrel and shearwater chicks.
James, producer Ben, thank you both. Let's talk about some of those tales. James, take us through the headlines of the embryology debates. We've covered this a lot, and it seems like reason's prevailed.
Yes, well, there'll be a lot of very relaxed and relieved stem cell scientists in the UK, I think, this week. Last week, Parliament voted on a whole set of amendments on four different issues. One was the hybrid human-animal embryos. The second was save your siblings, the conditions under which it's possible to use them to treat disease. The third issue was about the access for lesbians to IVF and indeed single women as well. And the fourth issue, perhaps the most contentious, was abortion and specifically the time limit after which it's not possible to have an abortion. At the moment, that stands at 24 weeks. And, well, in fact, the parliamentarians voted to keep it at 24 weeks.
So there were various amendments on those four issues tabled by opposition party MPs, and all of them were voted down. I mean, the Labour Party, which normally is whipped to vote in a certain way to support government bills, they were given a free vote on these things. And I think it was very interesting to see that despite that, MPs sort of went with reason and evidence and went forward with it. I mean, it always brings a tear to my eye to think that democracy could work so well.
Well, it was all quite exciting, I thought, because, you know, unlike a lot of the time where the MPs just traipse in and they're told exactly how to vote and, you know, they don't have to think about it, and most of the time, they had to come out with reasons for why they were going to vote different ways on some of these things. When a couple of weeks ago, when The Guardian did a poll of 109 MPs, what was interesting was you might expect things to split along party lines or along a kind of vaguely pro-science or less pro-science line, if you like. But actually, it was a very complicated picture, very mixed. You know, you had some MPs saying, I'm going to vote for this aspect, but I'm not going to vote for those other two, or vice versa. But as you say, you know, in the end, I think reason won out. And I think the reason for that is that scientists put in a huge amount of effort, a massive kind of lobbying effort, but a lot of stuff behind the scenes, sort of quiet persuasion, one-to-one meetings with MPs, that kind of thing. And, you know, I think that paid off.
Yeah, it was just a year ago that hybrid embryos were almost banned entirely by Caroline Flint, the health minister. Yeah. So, I mean, it's come a long way. But also what's a bit worrying about this is the way that the Tory party, the Conservatives, our opposition, have kind of shown their true colours on some of this stuff. So the leader of the Tory party was saying that he wanted abortion time limits reduced to something like 20 weeks. And, I mean, it's a bit worrying. I just wonder if he really means it or if he's just doing it for the sake of votes. If, as predicted, he might even be our next prime minister, this debate's never going to go away, is it? He'll just bring in legislation to try and reduce that time limit again.
Well, I heard Nadine Dorries, the backbench Tory MP, who brought the amendment for 20 weeks last week on the radio, and she implied that, you know, come the next parliament, which will probably happen in a couple of years, if, you know, David Cameron and his lot are in power, then, you know, they would consider bringing in new legislation along these lines, or at least bringing a vote back to the House when MPs could vote on it. It would be a free vote, because it traditionally is. But I don't know, I'm a little bit dubious that that would happen, because having had the voice of Parliament on this issue, I think it kind of kicks it into the long grass for sort of 10 years, unless there's, you know, unless some really important evidence comes along and changes the position in terms of the viability of premature babies. I mean, I personally am not convinced that that's kind of a killer argument anyway, but it's obviously part of the argument, and MPs have used that as a guiding position on where to put the upper time limit. But we'll have to see.
I suppose it shows that any hard-won freedom has to be refought again and again. So we've got to keep on. People have got to keep fighting for this stuff. Let's move on, though, to carbon nanotubes, a bit of a different subject. Carbon nanotubes are a sort of futuristic material that people think that you can use for all sorts of new, exciting things, but there's some potential health risks as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, in a way, they're not that futuristic. I mean, they're quite new in that they were only, they were only really sort of discovered and begun to be developed in 1991. But already they're appearing in all sorts of products, from car bodies to tennis rackets. I mean, in the future, some of their properties, their amazing ability to conduct heat and electricity are going to make them very useful in electronics and all sorts of other uses. What the researchers have shown is, in mice, there are some quite worrying things going on, in that when you inject carbon nanotubes into the body cavity where they migrate to this tissue called the mesothelium, there you get a problem where the cells that try to clear them up can't cope with them, because they're sort of long and thin. The cells that try to engulf them and get rid of them just can't do it. And so you get this, you can see these pictures down a microscope of the cell enclosed around this long, thin rod, and the cell just can't do anything. It's having this bit of carbon nanotube sticking out of either side.
Sounds a bit like asbestos. Asbestosis sort of kills
very
people.
Much. And the argument is that maybe the same thing is going on, because with asbestosis, particularly a certain length of fibre, once you get beyond about 15 micrometres, that's the point at which these cells can't deal with it anymore. Those cells go into a state which causes inflammation, and 20 to 50 years down the line, you get a particular kind of cancer called mesothelioma, which is deadly. So the worry is that because this same process seems to be going on, we have to be very, very careful with carbon nanotubes. Now, the scientists have caught this very early. They can't, at the moment, they can't be sure that all of those steps in the chain are there. And anyway, you wouldn't want to wait 20 years to see whether people start getting this cancer. But it's a warning to say, right, okay, we need to treat this material as if it's the same as asbestos, really. And so, certain procedures need to be in place for people using it, or when you're breaking down the products that is contained within it.
Well, why don't you take us through a couple of the things that people might use carbon nanotubes for? Because how likely is it that you or I in 10 years' time will be exposed to this stuff?
Well, most of the problems with exposure are likely to be in the places that manufacture it, frankly. So, it's a kind of health and safety at work issue, and, the sort of people who go in and clean out the furnaces or whatever, and are likely to encounter it as a sort of dust that can go into the lungs. They can go in wearing respirators and, hopefully be protected that way. Now, in terms of consumers, the researchers say, the risk when these things are actually enclosed in materials like in a golf club or a tennis racket or something like that is much, much lower, because, what you're worried about is breathing it in. So if it's kind of in a resin, then, you're not too worried about it. However, they did say, the risks are so significant that the onus really is on demonstrating that the exposure is low, rather than just assuming it's low because it's enclosed within those products. But really, the most dangerous potential bit, I think, for consumers is when you chuck these things away or they get broken up. So, in car bodies or something like that, when they're kind of smashed up, that's when they might be released again. And that's going to be at the end of a car's life, which might be 15, 20 years down the line.
OK, well, we'll leave that there. To have your say on any of this stuff, head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science or post a comment on our Facebook wall. The shortlist for the world's most prestigious science book prize was unveiled recently, and as always, it's an interesting pick of this year's crop. Craig Venter is one of three newcomers up for this year's Royal Society Prize for Science Books. His autobiography, Life Decoded, will slug it out with five other works written by four practicing scientists and two science writers. The books themselves cover a wide range of scientific issues, including climate change, the history of maths, astronomy, and genetics. The writer Fionn Haig was on the judging panel. I asked her what she's looking for in a good science book.
That's a really good question, because in many ways it's the same as asking what makes a good book, isn't it? I think a good science book needs to have a really riveting message, some excellent content, as it were. It needs to have a good structure and a good compelling presentation. And then it needs to be written in a style that's accessible to you and me, to people who are not scientifically trained.
And be honest, did you like the whole long list? I mean, there's a few here on the short list we've got.
Yeah.
I'm sure you liked all of them. But the long list that came along to you first, were there any that you thought, goodness, I just can't go through this?
Well, we were given a huge big cardboard box of 94 books, and it would be quite miraculous.
You didn't have to read all of them, did you?
Absolutely.
Oh, my goodness.
I did a judging read of all of them, which is to say that we read as much as we need to of each one to decide whether it's in or out in terms of long list. And of course, you know, it would be miraculous if all of those were equally compelling in my view. But we had a lively discussion at long list stage, and we came up with 12 books that we could all agree had many merits. And the more lively discussion I expect will be the one about who's going to win at the end of the day.
Your latest book actually is about the women in Lloyd George's life, a world away from the sort of technical science that some of these are about.
Absolutely.
How did you end up judging a science book prize?
Well, I asked that question myself when I got the offer. I think it was a huge honour to be asked by the Royal Society to participate. They wanted somebody on the panel who didn't come from a scientific background. I can tell you I really fulfil that criteria.
What is your background?
Well, I'm predominantly arts. I read English at Oxford and then did a follow-up degree in medieval Welsh poetry in Aberystwyth. So it's a very different background. And they wanted somebody who could look at these books from the point of view of the general reader. And one of the reasons that I said yes when I was asked to do this was because I had read a couple of the previous winners and really enjoyed them. In particular, I think Bill Bryson's A Short History of Nearly Everything was the book that made me wish I'd paid more attention in science classes in school, because it really brought things alive. And I thought if we could help shine a light on another book that does that and helps people enjoy science as a reading subject, then that would be a terrific thing to do.
Well, you like you said in the long list, you read nearly 95 books or speed read that many. And whenever I find that I read science books sometimes, which I enjoy the most, it tends to be the ones that I want to tell everyone to read immediately. You think, this has opened my eyes to something I've never known before. You know, and I do have a bit of a science background, but I still am fascinated by genetics and all these things. Was there anything in the long list or even in this short list where there was a book which you thought, people must read this book? Is there something in it that I just think everyone should know?
Well, do you know, actually, almost all of the ones that are on the shortlist come into that category, and that's what makes them so compelling. And there were others, things that didn't quite measure up to our criteria this time round, which are still excellent books that I will be buying for my friends and family. Some of the more encyclopedia-based books we felt may not have the staying power of a longer work on a single subject, and so we didn't want to bring them forward into the shortlist. But they are fantastic books, and the kind of thing that I will be sending my godson at Christmas, that kind of exciting work.
Yeah, was there anything unexpected? It was something you thought, I don't think I'll ever be interested in that. I noticed on the shortlist is Ian Stewart's book on symmetry, and that's quite a mathematical and kind of very arcane subject, but Ian Stewart is very good at writing about this stuff, and I don't know, I mean... Did you somehow see symmetry in a new light? I mean, symmetry is essentially beauty. It's the way we think of it. We talk about aesthetics all the time, but that's all it is. It's just symmetry. How did that book, for example, grab you?
Well, you're right to point that one out as something I would never thought I would actually love reading, a book that is essentially a history of a branch of mathematics that is difficult. I mean, by any standards, it's difficult. I mean, around the table, it wasn't just me who was struggling with the actual mathematical content of this book. But his skill is such that he presents the story of symmetry in such a way that you can read it with or without an appreciation of the equations. And he has managed also to condense a very complex subject into a very readable length of a book. And it's beautifully produced, beautifully written, beautifully phrased. And so you can enjoy it very much as a non-mathematician. And that really did surprise me.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
Fionn Haigh there. James, what's the best science book you've read this year?
It's one that's on that list, and it's Craig Venter's autobiography. I was really pleasantly surprised.
There were some raised eyebrows about that, because it's an autobiography. It's not really a science book, is it?
Well, yes, I guess. I mean, I don't really know or care very much where they draw the boundaries, you know, on
there were bits of science in there.
I just mean on the Royal Society's list, you know, how they define it. But
There is actually a lot of science in there, and there's a really interesting portrayal of, you know, the development of a field, and a lot of detail about, you know, there was a surprising amount of scientific detail in there, but actually told in a much more accessible way than I'd expected. And also, what I liked about it was there was a really interesting portrayal of the kind of backstabbing that goes on, not just in the kind of upper echelons. I mean, you know, during the Human Genome Project, you know, that was really kind of the stratosphere of scientific backstabbing you could possibly imagine. There was so much kind of bad feeling amongst extremely powerful people. But even before he reaches that stage in his career, you know, there's a time when basically someone in his department nicks some of his ideas and he doesn't really get the credit for it. And he's absolutely seething about it. But because he's just some small postdoctoral researcher, maybe he's even a PhD student at the time, his boss kind of says, look, you've got to leave it because this guy is just got a bigger silverback than you.
Maybe that's what caused him to be as vicious and ruthless as he is.
There's a good tale of him fighting with a sea snake as well.
That's excellent. Science and sea snakes. My favourite book this year, which isn't even on the shortlist, I don't know if it was on the long list, was Lee Smolin's book, The Trouble with Physics, which was a little bit hard going at points, but just brilliant and really beautifully written and humble as well, in that he's doing what scientists should do when it comes to fundamental physics and put their hands up and say, look, we just don't know, we don't have the evidence. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about this stuff before, about, you know, how much evidence do you need and everything for something to be a scientific theory, and he goes through that beautifully. I mean, if you want to know how science works properly and why it's sort of failing itself, that's a great book to read. But James, what's your tip to join the likes of David Badanis and Philip Ball to win this year's prize?
Gosh, I think that A Life Decoded has to be a hot
favourite. Has to be in there, doesn't it?
Really.
He's a good PR man, isn't he, Venter?
Yes, he knows his stuff. Actually, you mentioned David Badanis there, obviously a great friend of the pod.
He is.
But I read Passionate Minds, you know, a few months ago. Now, I'm not quite sure whether it fits into this year's list in, you know, whether it would have been judged amongst all the other 94 books that poor Fionn Hegh had to read. But I really enjoyed that. I mean, that's all about Voltaire and his steamy love affair with a woman who was also an extremely interesting.
Du Châtelet.
Indeed, yeah, she was an extremely interesting character and a kind of, you know, scientist philosopher in her own right, but never got the kind of credit for it. But that's a great book.
Excellent. I'm not going to tell you what Ben's just whispered into my ear when I said L'Emilie du Châtelet, but the winner of the Royal Society Science Book Prize will be announced on Monday, June the 12th. Find out first who'll win, probably, at guardian.co.uk/science. Now, let's return to our interview with Simon Singh and our discussion on alternative medicine. One of the most controversial things about homeopathy is the fact that it's available on the NHS. Now, the tide is turning in this regard, at least in financial terms, but Simon told me that a lot of alternative treatment is handed out by people and authorities who really should know better.
Again, one of the things we ask in the book is why do so many people believe and invest money and their hope and their health in alternative therapies when the evidence suggests it does, so much of it doesn't work? And there are several reasons, and one of them is, well, the government, via the NHS, invests in homeopathy and some other alternative therapies.
So it gives it credibility.
Yeah, they wouldn't do that unless it works. Well, unfortunately, the NHS can be a little bit silly sometimes, and this is a very good example of that. You know, some universities offer degrees in homeopathy and complementary medicine in general. Good universities, like the University of Westminster, has a very good reputation in many areas, and yet it seems to have sold its integrity to offer courses in subjects which have no scientific background whatsoever, and they're offering bachelors in science in these courses. So again, if I'm an 18-year-old, I'm thinking, well, there really must be something in homeopathy. I can study it as a degree. If I'm a patient, I think there really must be something in homeopathy because my homeopath has a Bachelor of Science from the University of Westminster. And so all these people are contributing to an idea that these therapies work.
Why aren't doctors and pharmacists and people who've actually been trained in recognising clinical trials and who should really actually know better in these situations, why aren't they telling us not to take these things seriously?
I don't know. I'm beginning to realise how fed up they can get. It seems like an unwinnable battle in many ways. you know, you turn on the radio and you'll have an alternative therapist, you know, telling about the wonders of their weird and wonderful therapy. You go to hundreds of pages on the internet. It's impossible to police the internet. Doctors are busy treating their patients and just trying to...
So it's a marketing exercise, basically. It's because of lack of marketing.
Well, there's a huge marketing exercise from the alternative therapy community. Mm. I did a phone-in program the other week, and, you know, I turned up on this phone-in program. I was debating with a homeopath, and... the night before I went on the program, I realized homeopaths were emailing each other wildly saying, ring in this program. Here's the telephone number. Tell your positive stories of homeopathy. You know, we must save homeopathy. So there's a huge kind of organized movement out there to save and protect homeopathy and the other many other alternative therapies.
And it's just like a cult, basically.
It's an industry. It's an industry. I mean, I'm not a big fan of, you know, the huge profits made by the pharmaceutical industries, but the alternative medical industry also makes huge profits. The difference is that conventional medicine is highly regulated and alternative medicine isn't. And I don't see why somebody should be able to sell a herbal remedy which hasn't been tested for safety or efficacy, whereas the pharmaceutical companies really do have to jump through hoops and so on to try and prove to us that their products work. You know, they do some not very good things as well, but at least there's some level of regulation there to protect us, whereas there's very, very little regulation to protect us from the alternative medicine community.
What is it about this whole area in your research that made you most upset or angry? Because you said you got angrier and angrier as you wrote the book, and you seem to be getting more and more angry through the interview. But it seems to me it's about the power these people seem to have without any justification. I mean, what else was it about it that really got your goat?
I think at the end of the day, you have to say who's responsible for this rise. Now, if you're an alternative therapist, you're there to make money, or you're there because you have a genuine belief that you can heal people. So you're bound to push your product as much as you can. So who should be protecting us against these things? Well, the Advertising Standards Authority, you know, aren't as effective as they could be, and they're probably overstretched. The government just doesn't seem to be that interested. They've, in fact, if anything, relaxed the legislation on homeopathy.
Yet they claim to be a pro-science government.
They claim to be a pro-science government, but on the other hand, you know, why stop alternative therapy when we don't have to pay for it? You know, the vast majority of the money seems to come from people's own pockets. Why try and stop something which has a popular and loyal following, which will only make us unpopular? I think The Guardian wrote a very long and interesting piece about the number of MPs that had signed an early day motion backing homeopathy. I think it'd be great if the politicians actually had the guts to stand up and say, actually, no, this is.
There are a few, yeah, but not many.
Yeah, no, I mean, there needs to be a huge change. And in a way, the reason we've written the book is to say, well, if politicians aren't going to say it as it is, then, you know, we need to get the information out there somehow.
Time for us to depart into the never never. Head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science to find links to all the stories we've discussed this week. And if there's something you desperately want to tell us, post a comment on the Facebook wall. The full interview with Simon Singh is available as this week's Science Extra, and his book, Trick or Treatment, written with Edzard Ernst, is out to buy now. My thanks to everyone in the pod, well, just James, I suppose, and this could be the last time for a while, so, you know, enjoy the first few weeks of fatherhood, James, otherwise we'll see you next week. if you're getting bored, come back in, bring the baby in. He's probably going to have more to say than I do.
The baby, a pod debut.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green. I'm Alok Jha, thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.